and called their father's name. Mektu stops dead.
"Do you see where we are?" he says. "The Zavacindran's clinic, where we started. Look, that's the alley right there."
"God's damn," says Khondri, for his brother is right.
"We're going to run out of wall. It turns a corner soon, back toward the cliffs."
"And she could trap us in that corner," says Mektu.
Another burst of red light. This time Khondri sees it plainly. A shooting star, lovely, dazzling, with a bright tail of crimson. But the star does not wink out. It plummets, blazing still, at a sharp angle like a downward sword stroke, and vanishes behind the wall. For an instant, the light flares brighter than ever, and the men on the ramparts let out a wail. Then the light goes out.
"I think it struck the earth," says Mektu.
"A shooting star can't strike the earth."
"Yes, it can. Read a book."
The thought comes in a flash. He will never read another book. Never learn if Mektu is mad or well-informed. Never stargaze with Arikina or show their children the night sky. No matter how long death walks at your elbow, the thought of it can still pounce and astonish. And that is how it will happen, finally. In the long storm of arrows, one at last knows your name. Somewhere off to their right, a Sivkrin growls. Ahead, another cat gives an answering cry. Two Rasanga, very close. And that, yes, that is the pounding of hooves.
"They've opened the Dawn Gate," says Mektu. "The whole force must be looking for us now."
Soldiers ahead, soldiers to their right, and behind them a girl who kills with a touch. They flee in the only direction remaining, straight to the foot of the wall. There is no gate in sight, but not far to their left is another spot where the inner wall is crumbling, or rather has crumbled, into a steep, leaning hill of rocks and masonry, almost as high as the outer facade. They scurry closer. Two sentries pass overhead, bearing no light, picking their way along the broken parapet. Khondri sees no other sentries, but lamplight shines from the windows of a turret some 500 yards to the south. The rocks are massive. The pile has the look of a death trap. Khondri tugs at a great chunk of stone at shoulder height. It does not visibly yield, but his hand senses a looseness there, and gravel pelts his feet.
"Mech," he says, "can you climb this?"
He feels heartless, putting the question to his brother. But Mektu's thoughts have run in the same direction.
"Watch me," he says, and begins to scramble like a goat. "Be careful, dammit!"
At first the going is simpler than he feared. But the higher they climb, the more the pile narrows, and the more unstable it becomes. They slow their ascent, then slow further. Rocks grind and shift. Gravel sluices like water around their feet.
"Gods," whispers Khondri. "This whole thing could come down."
Mektu says nothing. Khondri can sense his terror. This is a far greater danger than the rotten stair. The ground feels distant, but the parapet is still 6 feet above. He reaches up for the next handhold, and a stone the size of a bucket gives way. The whole pile trembles as it crashes to the street.
"Don't move," whispers Khondri.
"I won't," says his brother.
They are two flies on a sleeper's lips. A very light sleeper. Khondri looks his brother in the eye.
"I'm going to pull myself up on the platform, then turn and lift you, by the armpits. You protect those stitches with your hands."
"All right."
Khondri reaches up to the walkway, probing for a handhold. Stones move underfoot, but not too many or too large. If only Mech were like this more often. If only he would say, "All right." Life would be sweeter, the struggle more bearable. His urge to kick the fool in the face would—
"Hingeman!"
Khondri's head snaps around. Three Chiloto soldiers are scaling the rubble behind them. Awkwardly, gingerly, their horses abandoned in the street.
"I told you,"
crows the same voice.
"It's them, the abominations. Follow the white child," I said.
"Batali?" says Mektu.
"That's you, isn't it?"
"Mech!"
cries the second soldier. Khondri winces, but there are the grouse-wing ears to prove it. The man is Batali, his brother's best friend.
They really did let you join the cavalry, says Mech 2,
his voice almost proud.
Mech, Mech, says Batali. You're a traitor. Oh, Mech, you have to die.
Shut your mouth and watch your balance,
snaps the third soldier, an officer by the tone he takes.
And you, blood traitors, you know it's over. Come down. There's no way off that wall.
How could you do it? Says Batali. How could you shed their holy blood? I didn't mean to. You cut Lord Ojulon to pieces, says Batali. And Lord Garatajic. You stuck a knife in his chest.
They are within 10 feet. Debris cascades at their every movement, but somehow their confidence is unshaken.
Batali, says Mektu, helpless. You and I, we're... No, fucker, no! I'm not your friend anymore. I can't be.
A catch in his voice. Condry gropes along the platform overhead.
If you reach the wall, the city guard will only kill you, says the officer. Come down, and we'll slay you painlessly. I'll tell the army you fought us to the end.
No, he won't,
shouts Batali suddenly.
They'll torture you. Stab yourselves or jump. The things they're planning.
Batali, says Condry. Is Garatajic dead? The soldiers lunge. With a groan, Condry pulls himself onto the walkway, rolls, grabs his brother by the shirt. Rocks are sliding. Batali and the third soldier snatch at Mektu's feet. Mektu kicks and flails. Then the whole face of the slope peels away like a rind. The horses bolt. The soldiers' cries are stillborn, dust choking them even before they are crushed, even before their bodies vanish from sight. Condry, veins popping, heaves his brother onto the wall.
He touched my foot, Con.
They're dead. Don't worry.
He touched my foot.
Mektu sobs like a baby in his arms. The officer was right, of course. The wall is 60 feet high and perfectly sheer on its outer face. How in Ong's name are they to descend? Condry looks north to the Dawn Gate. 20 or more Shessel are stationed by the iron doors, which have indeed been opened. Atop the wall, still distant, a few lantern-bearing figures are moving their way. He cannot tell if they are the city's soldiers or the prophets. What difference will it make? Night has fallen, but the plain is alive with light. Some of the shops and stalls of the desert market are on fire. The braver merchants are fighting the blaze. North of the city, one of the lookout towers is burning like a torch. And in the dark miles between the city and the Arig Hills, other fires are burning, crescent-shaped and low. Brush fires. And a stiff wind to fan them. Condry says a quick prayer for the people of the Lutaral, their winter crops, their homes. He pulls his brother up and leads him south. Falling stars. Tears of the gods. But who are they crying for? And who is to blame? Not us. That's impossible. What god could weep for Ojulon? He looks south along the wall. No one between them and the next turret, but the windows of the latter are alight. That way, he says, gesturing. If there's a way out of this mess, it's through that turret somehow. Mektu wipes his nose on his sleeve. Condry puts an awkward hand on his back. I'm sorry about Batali.
You called him a fool.
I'm still sorry. Mektu shrugs off his hand. Of course, Batali was a fool. Only a fool would risk closeness to Mektu at Eternity Camp. And what does that make you, Condry Hingeman? They walk. The platform is spongy with moss, leaves, underbrush. Also pitch black. After a few yards, Mektu bends and lifts something from the stone. What is it? A lamp. Hold it up. It's broken, Mech, and we shouldn't light it anyway.
Did I ask you to light it? Just take it. Can't you do that much?
Condry takes the dead lamp. They shuffle on, increasingly dazzled by the turret's windows.
Is there a bell? Says Mektu.
In the turret? I don't know. I can't see one. What the hell does it matter? Don't tell me you have some crackpot.
Why did it have to be him, Condry?
Do you think he volunteered?
Figures move past the windows. Not many. Perhaps just 3 or 4. Condrey has the beginnings of a hunch about Mektu's intentions, knows he wouldn't dare such a thing himself. They are 30 feet from the turret when the door bursts open.
Oil! Snaps Mektu. How much do you have? We're in the dark here, and you're lighting the place up like a grog hall!
His outburst appears to stun the young sentry in the doorway, both hands on his lowered spear.
We have just the one lantern, same as ever, he says. Who are you? Where's Agathon?
Where's Agathon? Mektu quickens his pace. He's dead, that's where. They sent him for oil, and he fell in the dark and broke his skull. Now they've sent us, and we almost fell. Here, take our lamp and give us yours.
He fell? Per Agathon is dead?
Sons of bitches!
Mektu has actually started crying again.
Don't pretend he was your friend! Did he wait all day to see you in the dinner line? Were you the only one who could make him smile?
Dinner line? Please, Condrey hears himself say. Just give us the lamp.
Mektu is snarling, one hand covering his wound. Behind the sentry, Condrey has a brief glimpse of the tower chamber, and a thick rope passing through the floor and ceiling. A bell pull. Two more guards join the first. They cluster in the doorway, peering into the dark. They are large, awkward, crowding each other, their spear points bobbing up and down. Younger than us, thinks Condrey.
Be reasonable, says the first sentry. We can't give you our only lamp.
Then fill ours, jackass, and hurry up, says Condrey.
He holds out the lamp, but it is his brother who seizes it. Brazen, Mektu swats the spears aside and thrusts the lamp into the sentry's hands. The sentry turns sidelong. Light from the doorway falls on the lamp. It is a relic. A joke. The mantle crushed. The oil pan split open like a fruit. Mektu roars with indignation. He snatches it back, turns it, hurls it from the wall.
Piece of shit! Stupid bastards! Why doesn't anyone cooperate?
He throws the sentry from the wall. Two fistfuls of shirt. A vicious movement. Release. The boy's face is horribly plain for an instant. He cries out, gripping the spear as though it were anchored somewhere. Condrey wants to be sick, but Mektu has already caught the other spears beneath his arm and is drawing his machete, and Condrey dives into battle at his side. One of the men manages to draw a dagger, but there is little contest. As Mektu grubbily slashes and stomps one man to death, Condrey lunges for the other, takes off the arm that reaches for the bell pull, cuts his throat on the upswing, stops the scream, and feels a twist in his brain, a spasm that almost brings him down atop the corpse. Then he is sick, copiously sick. Why should he live if the cost of staying alive is this butchery of innocence, if they are the weeds between him and the future, the path he must clear to Arikina? Dr. Arikina, the healer. She will hate him if she ever learns what he's become. Mektu, steaming with blood to the elbows, reaches for the bell pull and begins to raise it, length after length. Condrey sinks to the floor. He cannot weep. He doesn't have that in him, suddenly. But he cannot go on killing, either. Not for his brother's sake, or his own.
Condrey, says Mektu, we're saved. This thing must be 80 feet long.
The coils of rope spill around them. Over the trickling puddles, the sectioned limbs. Mektu drags the end of the rope out the door.
It will reach the ground, Con, he calls. Stand up! This is it!
Condrey studies the face of the man he's just killed. Bulging eyes, wide open mouth. It comes again, that inner twisting, that pinch. Be reasonable. Mektu puts a hand on his shoulder, reading him as only Mektu ever could.
Do you know why you have to get up? He says.
Condrey shakes his head.
Because Garatajic was good to us, Condrey. And he put a letter in your hands.
He looks up. Mektu, this monster, his kin. But the truth of the monster's words cleaves down through Condrey's despair. He stands. He lifts his brother's shirt and sees that the stitches are intact. There is blood on Mektu's stomach, but none of it is his own. Well then, survival. They wind the rope 3 times about a solid-looking section of parapet. Now, just tie a loop for me to stand in, says Mektu. No length to spare, unless you want me dangling by the arms. Khandri does not want him dangling by the arms, but lowering him is not easy. The rope binds and snags and leaps when Khandri stops straining against it. Time and again he must hurl himself with all his might against his brother's freefall, then relax one muscle at a time, waiting for the next jarring yank. He leans into the effort, over the inner wall and the city. Goodbye, Mab Makutin. Never will be too... No. Oh, no. The white child is standing beside a corpse, beside the body of the sentry Mektu hurled from the wall. She bends and pokes at the shattered skull. Intrigued, she studies her fingers, scarlet on chalk. Then she looks up at Khandri with those dead black eyes. Khandri imagines, with instant horror, that she wears another's face. A familiar face. But whose?
Lantor, you would not help me escape?
Her lips do not seem to move, and yet he hears her. And suddenly the sky is full of shooting stars. They scatter and flash like scarlet minnows. They skip and go dark and blaze again. They trickle earthward like rain on glass. For an instant, he is aware of nothing but their beauty. A heaven strange and infinite and open. The night of blood. When the gods weep tears of fire. Distant shouts. Men with torches are running south along the wall, straight toward him. His brother is shouting too. Can the word be... horse? The rope goes slack. Mektu has reached the ground, or released the rope in any case. Khandri glances into the city once more. The white child is smiling at him.
I'll find you.
An arrow slings past his ear. The men on the wall are closing. Khandri ties a clumsy timber hitch in the rope, tests the knot. One shaving of the moon has risen above the Arig Hills. There, backlit, is the hermit, where the general's men will be waiting. And there is Mektu, running east, arms flailing like a madman, abandoning him. Khandri tests the knot. Another arrow closer than the first. He steps backward off the wall. It is not hard to catch up with Mektu, but it is very hard not to turn him by the shoulder, drive a fist into his teeth. Ditch me now, will you? After everything? After what we've done today? He is reaching for that shoulder when Mektu hears him and turns. What the fuck took you so long? There's a horse! Help me catch it! Scared to death, poor thing. It must have bolted. Khandri hears the animal, snorting and stamping. They follow the sound into a stand of wiry trees, and there it is, a dark, skinny mare, hauling at reins snagged in the underbrush. Terrified, not wounded. And the stab in his chest is sharper than any other that evening, for it is hope again. That crazed, persistent suitor, that tease who cannot break with him, or stay. The mare has no saddle, and no wish to remain anywhere near Mab Makutin. The trouble is not catching the lean mare or even riding her, with one arm clamped around Mektu's belly and the other gripping both reins. The problem is her fear. Once the reins are free, she runs like a mad thing, and it is all Khandri can do to guide her out of the advancing brush fires. The next hours pass in a bewildering dream. A level mile they race over in silence. A blazing silo, a pair of jackals licking their lips. Three enormous shooting stars raking the heavens, the last unmistakably striking the northeast plain in a burst of fire, and a shockwave he feels through the body of the horse. A crowd of farmers joining hands around a temple in flames, singing a prayer song. A ghoul tugging a corpse from the ground with hands and teeth. Another soundless mile. Then hoofbeats. Many hoofbeats, and a storm of riders engulfs them, charging west toward Mab Makutin. 60 or 70 warriors flowing indifferent around them as though their horse were a stump. The light is too dim to see them clearly, but then a last red star streaks overhead, and Khandri sees a dozen faces he recalls from Tabasa's bunker, and with them Telupeke, mounted behind a stranger, a glazed ferocity in her smile. No one looks at the brothers. The host is gone, And what are they to do but keep riding? They keep riding. There is no pursuit. The hill called the Hermit rears up, and the mare, not calm, but exhausted at least, bears them quickly around its southern flank. Condrey, too, is bone-weary. They have been awake for some 30 hours, and he cannot keep his thoughts from the morbid question of when, if ever, they will again know a night of untroubled sleep. But there ahead, just as Stilts promised, is the rock wall. They halt the mare, and almost at once, the sound of other hooves reach their ears. Down from the shadowy hillside come 5 riders, their clothes and horses so dark that at first Condrey can perceive no more than their eyes. At their lead is a small, broad-shouldered figure in a tight-fitting leather jerkin.
"The man in the hat sends his greetings," he says without preamble.
"We're not too late, then?" says Condrey.
"You are quite late," says the rider. "But 3 hours ago, our orders changed. If the moon had climbed another finger, we were to ride out and seek you."
"Seek us?" says Mektu. "I didn't think your boss particularly cared whether we showed up or not."
"If he did not care, would he have helped you to begin with? Come, shift over. That poor animal of yours is weak with fear."
At the man's gesture, a spare horse is brought alongside their own, and rough hands help them slide from one animal to the other.
"Now follow," says the first rider, "but make no sound."
The path is long and circuitous, winding deep into the smooth-sided hills. They climb steadily, and the wind grows strong and cold. Once they halt in a patch of moonlight. From a hilltop above comes a faint cry, like the echo of a curlew's call. One of the riders cups his hands to his mouth and gives an answering cry, and the journey resumes. Condrey is nodding over the saddle horn. Mektu is snoring on his shoulder. As his eyes grow heavier, the despised sound infiltrates his dreams, mutating into the bellow of a camel, until he is certain the spiteful creature has begun to gnaw at his shirt. He tries to pull away, but another camel has locked its jaws on his leg. Their obtuse lowing surrounds him. Perhaps they will gnaw him to death.
"Wake up, Chilodo."
The horse is stopped. Their escort has disappeared. In their place stands Mansari, Tabasa's oddly feline warrior, shaking Condrey by the leg.
"Dismount," he says. "You're to be welcomed, earnestly, this time, despite that cloud of, misfortune that clings to you."
Condrey can still hear the camels, and now, fully awake, he detects their oddly agreeable, scalded milk stench. His brother, already dismounted, is leaning against the horse like a drunkard. Condrey swings a leg over the mare's rump and slides to the ground, and is startled to find himself on sand. He pulls Mektu upright.
"You bleeding?"
"No, stop asking me that."
Mansari smiles thinly. "You are most certainly brothers," he says.
They are in a narrow canyon with a floor of soft sand. The vertical walls are smooth and undercut, as though by some vanished river. But human hands have shaped this place as well. Carved into the cliffs are 5 or 6 levels of galleries, revealed in the dark outlines of pillars and porticos, windows and stairs. The openings throb faintly with firelight. Here at ground level, however, is the largest opening by far, a rough cave mouth, 10 feet high and many hundreds wide, like the maw of some primitive whale. A line of guards stands at this threshold. Behind them, in the vast interior, Condrey dimly perceives a throng. It is not an army. There are children and frail elders, a few dogs, many camels. Some of the people are asleep, wrapped in blankets or crowded onto rugs, but most are awake, murmuring, busy with inscrutable tasks. Deep inside the cavern, a few small ground fires burn.
"Are these people your prisoners?" asks Condrey.
"Idiotic question," says Mansari. "This is the cavern of the owls, and a holy place. The hill clans have always sheltered here in times of war and disaster. Tonight, they are sheltering from the celestial fires, and from your... comrades."
"Former comrades," says Mektu.
Have the Prophet's forces come this far, right into the hills? Asks Khandri.
Not as far as we know, says Mansari.
But one can see their handiwork from many a hilltop. The fearless new Orthodox cavalry, crossing blades with goat herds, laying siege to barns.
Why are you guarding the cave mouth, then?
Try thinking. It is a beneficial habit in a soldier, says Mansari. This cavern is far from the Lutaral plain, and little known to outsiders, but it is not impregnable.
So you don't trust these hill people?
No clan is without its, deviance, says Mansari. Some wretches in the Lutaral have even embraced your prophet's cause. We can take no chances tonight.
And someone betrayed your general, Khandri thinks.
This is a box canyon, isn't it? Says Mektu, squinting at the darkness. Just one way in or out?
Climbers and mountain goats might find another way.
Mansari, says Khandri. What about our friends, the Parthian woman and the smith?
Turn around, Khan, says Mektu.
Chindalin and Eshet are standing just beyond the line of guards. The smith is bickering, pointing at the brothers, demanding to be let through. One of the guards looks at Mansari, who nods. A spear rises, opening a path, and their uncle barrels toward them. He does not shout, for the hush upon the crowd is somehow law, but there is no disguising his relief.
You mad lost dogs! We were going out of our minds! What in Ong's name happened to you?
Not waiting for an answer, he throws a burly arm around each brother's neck and pulls them close. Eshet, coming up behind him, crosses her arms over her chest and says nothing. But then she catches Khandri's eye and holds him there, a moth on a pin, wondering if she is going to laugh or break down in tears. But this is Eshet. She does neither. Her gaze slides to Mektu, and Khandri wonders if his brother still has a chance.
You've bathed, he says to Chindalin.
I have, says his uncle. And someone's going to trim this wild hedge of a beard, thank the gods. You're supposed to walk out of the desert looking like a crazed holy man, not go in that way.
Very witty, very droll, says Mansari. Come, the general is waiting.
So he can ride somehow, thinks Khandri. Within the cave, animals outnumber people. There are donkeys, mules, goats with soft satin ears, and camels. 200 or 300 camels, filling the low space with their brays and snorts and snuffles, their flatulence and flies. Some are asleep beside their handlers, necks and chins flat on the ground. Others stand with great loads strapped atop them like peddlers' bundles, seemingly ready to depart. A boy appears with a torch. Mansari takes it and chucks him under the chin by way of thanks. The people grow quiet as they pass, their dark eyes staring. Khandri and Mektu are a terrible sight. Most of the huddled figures are small and sun-wrinkled, dressed in canutes or the plain tunics and sarongs of the Lutaral. But a few are clearly wealthy, resembling in their attire the seated guests in Tabasa's bunker. Khandri blinks. It is more than a resemblance. There, in a cloud of blue smoke from the water pipe he is smoking, is the very merchant who complained to Stilts about the general's priorities. And there is the mysterious Prince Niraba, not alone this time, but attended by some dozen guards, all of them slender and olive-skinned like the young monarch. The prince is seated in some manner of canvas chair, studying a book by the light of a small oil lamp. The lamp in turn dangles from a kind of shepherd's stick at his elbow, thrust deep into the sand. Goats and dogs trot about him. Moths swarm to the lamp. Peasant children watch him, dumbstruck. The prince takes no notice. He reads. And there, finally, is Dimas, the caravan owner. The short, plump man who had identified the severed heads. The man who had told Eshet to come back with 30 soldiers. What's Dimas's business here?
Prophet, says Mansari. If he can convince Mr. Ifimar, the caravan master, to port his wares across the desert. That's Ifimar on his right.
Dimas looks even smaller beside his companion, a tall, sinewy man dressed in canute and headscarf,
dark jewels on his fingers, massive broadsword on his belt. He turns, and Khandri sees his profile. Long face, thin eyebrows like wires stitched to his forehead. Ifimar and his employer are inspecting a row of camels jostling at a water trough. The beasts drink with abandon, noisy as drainpipes in a storm. Ifimar feels their stomachs, groins, ankles, utterly absorbed in his task. "Caravan owners rarely brave the desert," says Mansari. "They hire masters to take that risk, but when the profits are tallied, they still claim the, lion's share. Ifimar's fees are twice that of other masters, but that is the privilege of excellence. He is one of the finest masters ever to work the ravenous lands."
Khandri starts. "You mean the caravan might be setting off after all, without the 30 guards Deimos wanted?"
"It might," says Mansari. "If he opens his purse a little wider, and Ifimar agrees."
"Then we have to speak with them. Uncle, Eshet, have you?"
Eshet shakes her head. "Deimos said he was through with discussing men he never met. Khandri's right, Mr. Mansari. We must go to them, right now. What you must do, Parthen woman, is greet your host and benefactor. Don't worry about the caravan. No one leaves this place without the general's blessing. Come along."
The cave stretches deep into the hill. They pass doorways, side chambers, stairs. Mektu begins to chatter at Eshet.
"A nurse was flirting with me. I tried not to notice."
Khandri and Chindalin bring up the rear. They turn left into a straight, breeze-swept passage. Khandri grips his uncle's arm.
"I'm going to ask you something," he says, "and I won't take kindly to evasion."
Chindalin is startled.
"Hurrah, boy, that's a hell of a way to pose a question. Can't you just..."
"What is the White Child?"
His uncle misses a step.
"You know, don't you?" says Khandri. "You've known this whole fucking time."
"No, no, I don't. It's not what you think.
Forget what I think. Talk to me."
"Khandri, the general's up to something."
Chindalin's voice is very low.
"Evasion.
The hell it is."
Chindalin slows his pace, letting the others vanish around a curve.
"Listen to me. In that mill, Tabassa barely spoke to us. Tonight, he's been shouting for you every 15 minutes. The brothers, why haven't they arrived? What's keeping those Chiloto fools? I don't know what his game is, but he's itching to have you and Mektu under his thumb. We need to think fast, Khandri. We need to know what to say to him."
"How about the truth?" says Khandri. "A little more truth from everyone. That couldn't hurt."
"Couldn't it?
Have you seen that creature, uncle? It smelled us from blocks away. It picked out the building where we'd hidden ourselves and made right for us, as if it could see through walls."
"Khandri," says Chindalin, "you're upset and exhausted. I realize that. But shut up about the child. The prophet collects freaks. So what? We have bigger problems."
Her face was familiar. "Why is that, uncle?"
"Because you're upset."
Khandri spins his uncle brutally around.
"You're fucking right I'm upset. That thing killed with a touch. And it called us by Papa's name."
Horror in his uncle's face. He clutches at Khandri, mouth working, and Khandri realizes the smith has been fighting panic from his first word.
"Don't blame Lantor," he whispers.
"Blame him for what?" says Khandri. "Did he make that thing somehow?"
"No, no. Fucking hell. You better just explain."
But as they round the curve, they find the others stopped and waiting. Mansari watches the stragglers keenly, and suddenly Khandri knows his uncle is right. They must not speak of the child now, must not provide Tabassa's men with any new reasons for fear or mistrust. Not until the general shows his hand.
"If your little conference is, concluded," says Mansari.
Behind him stands a pair of swordsmen. Spiked to the wall between the guards is something dark and shaggy, a sheepskin. At a nod from Mansari, one of the men lifts it like a curtain, revealing a small door-shaped hole. Within are warmth and firelight, and many soldiers, and dim, smoke-thickened air.
After you, says Monsari.
The chamber is large, but does not feel so, crowded as it is with Tabasa's men. A rough circle, it has other entrances scattered about the perimeter, and a great fire in a hearth at the center. The smoke vanishes above through a funnel-like hole. Many of the warriors from Apuk's mill are here. Stilts is holding a basket of oranges, tossing them to the waiting men and women with quick snaps of his wrist. A woman wags a finger at a small brown dog. Spider, the bald captain with the birthmark, is arm-wrestling a larger man and winning. Observing the match from a seat near the fire is the general himself. He sees them, beckons them near. Spider, too, looks up, and his opponent takes the opportunity to slam his hand down in triumph. Tabasa laughs. Therefore, everyone laughs. Condry senses a difference in the way the soldiers look at them. At Apuk's mill, there had been suspicion and little else. Now there is excitement, an eagerness almost breaking out into smiles. But there is still uncertainty, a waiting to see more. He's told them we're good news, thinks Condry, but he hasn't told them why.
No sign of girl trouble, says Mektu. I mean, trouble girl.
I wonder if she's...
Talupeke can take care of herself, says Eshet, with a quick glance at Chindelin.
They thread a path to the general. He beams at them, and his hands keep beckoning, closer, closer. When Condry is less than an arm's reach away, Tabasa pulls him down and kisses his forehead. He does the same to Mektu.
You're alive! That's very good. We have a great deal to discuss after you shed those blood blotters you're wearing and wash the stench away. I mean to take good care of you, boys. You won't be sorry you've joined us. Send the wine back this way, whoever's hogging it.
Now all the men are smiling. Condry forces himself to do the same, but he cannot force himself to believe in this charade. Tabasa's kiss has put him in mind of a farmer kissing a prize pumpkin before it is weighed at a fair. Someone thrusts a wineskin at him. He takes a long, thirsty pull.
That's the way, says Tabasa. Corporal, tell the women to feed these gentlemen. After your first errand, of course.
A young soldier salutes, vanishes. Condry passes the skin to Mektu, then bows low. General Tabasa, he says, the Zavacindrans saved my brother's life. We thank you with all our hearts. The general's smile does not change.
Your thanks should begin with Talupeke and with Master Stilts. She's the reason I spoke to you in the first place. And he's the one who swore that you were who you claimed to be. Hingemans, that is.
He knew our father, sir, says Condry.
We all do, says Tabasa.
You know him?
The last time I checked, Lantor Hingeman was very much alive.
Condry turns and embraces Mektu. Chindelin, with a rumbling laugh, throws his arms around them both. Hope is one thing, news is another. Tears well in Condry's eyes.
I knew it! I knew it! Burbles Mektu. You can't kill our papa, can you, brother? Can you?
Condry releases him, grinning, wiping his eyes.
Do you know where he is, General Tabasa?
We know, says the general. And we have just sent him word that you're among us, although the missive may be long in reaching him. Go and rest a while, though. I must see to various matters now that you are safely arrived.
He looks them up and down, then adds,
I have urged him to join us. No doubt he will be eager to see his sons.
Mektu, forgetting himself, squeezes the uncapped wineskin, spraying Chindelin below the belt. Tabasa roars with laughter at the smith's embarrassment.
Go! Mr. Stilts, rid me of these brave buffoons. The high chamber, I think, and some privacy for Mistress Eshet. Food will follow, along with such comforts as we can provide. Be gone now, Chilotos. I will send for you presently.
Stilts claps a hand on Condry's arm. The interview has ended. The older man takes a torch from another's hand, and the travelers follow him out through another sheepskin-cloaked doorway. They stand now on a kind of landing at the foot of a narrow stair.
The general means it, you know, says Stilts as he begins to climb.
You're to meet again in 2 hours, and privately. Be careful now. Some of these stairs are broken.
The hell with the stairs, says Mektu. Where's our father, Mr. Stilts?
But Stilts, to no one's surprise, dodges the question with a hazy promise. The general will reveal everything in time.
What about sleep, says Eshet. Are we ever to be left alone to sleep?
Stilts just chuckles. His torch knocks along the ceiling, black and glistening with untold ages of soot. The staircase meanders upward through the stone, like a worm wriggling toward daylight. They pass other landings, where corridors branch off into the darkness, some sealed behind iron gates, others simply vanishing into the dark. They climb higher and higher. Khandri thinks of the rooms and balconies he had glimpsed on their arrival. Surely they have passed the highest of these already, which means they are bound for some secret place, without windows on the canyon. A place never meant for common folk. At last the staircase ends. Before them another corridor opens, wide and straight and lit by several torches. A chill breeze travels it, tossing sand about their feet. Eshet hugs herself, and Mektu puts his arm over her shoulder. Further along the passage, more sheepskins are pegged to the stone, cloaking further openings. From one, a gleam of firelight escapes, from another, a whiff of steam. Stilts leads them down the passage.
You've nothing to fear tonight, he says. Our forces are mainly here in the north galleries, but we're watching every approach to the cavern. The general has shown you rare favor, by the way. These were his own quarters in the past. Tonight, men begged for the honor of carrying him up those steps, but he wouldn't hear of it. I'll curl up with you, lads, he told them. One more dog in the den.
Do you mean we are to be left alone up here? Asks Mektu.
Officers will bed down in the side chambers, says Stilts. And there are servants about, of course. Good Hill Clan people, from families well known to us. I selected them myself.
The passage ends in a dramatic archway engraved with odd images. Horses, camels, wriggling serpents, radiant suns. Actual curtains, not skins, have been mounted on the stone there, and when Stilts parts them, a sumptuous chamber is revealed. Like everything they have seen, it is carved from the living rock. There is no furniture at all. But here again, a generous fire is blazing, this time in a hearth emitting a low moan, wind on the distant chimney. The floor, swept clean of sand, is strewn with rugs and pillows. There is a samovar on a stand by the fire, a rich smell of bricer wood, a small pyramid of folded clothes. Slender hands part the curtains on the far wall, and a young woman appears, dressed humbly like the peasants below. She is carrying a wide brass dish upon which something smolders, incense, perhaps. She jumps at the sight of them, then shyly lowers her eyes and advances into the room. Stilts walks forward and takes the dish. The woman bows and flees.
So much room, says Eshet.
Her eyes seek out Khandri, and for the second time that evening, he feels the sharpness of her look. Not a coincidence. What is it you need to tell me, Eshet?
There's a bath chamber, Stilts is saying. Just off the passage. You saw the seam. And if you follow the girl through that doorway, Mistress Eshet, you'll find an alcove when you can sleep apart from these hairy beasts. Your clothes will be in there already. But we bought clothes, says Eshet. Dry food as well, and Fosca. Everything you told us to buy.
Did you? Stilts looks mildly chagrined.
Well, it seems the general is in a lavish mood. Enjoy it while it lasts.
Where's that girl gone, by the way? Asks Chindelin.
To fetch your dinner, I expect.
I meant Talupeke, says the smith.
He speaks with a casual air any fool could see through. Khandri and Mektu exchange a look. They have not mentioned their glimpse of her riding west over the plain. Stilts studies Chindelin for a moment before he answers.
My niece, he says at last, is following her heart's desire, and taking revenge for the slaughter at the Maghreb defile.
Few of your prophet's cavalry will make it back to Legion headquarters. The word Maghreb will be written on the foreheads of the slain.
It's quite a party, this night of blood, says Mektu.
Keep that flippant tongue in your mouth, says the Naduman.
This is no party. It's a reckoning. Whether you believe in the Darsenic or not hardly matters. The clans of the Lutaral have seen one invasion after another, one bloody tyrant after another. They march in and take what they like, cattle, grain, children, hope. If they've exploded with anger and frustration, the only wonder is that it took so long. The brush has been piling up for decades, for generations. The spark had to come. His vehemence catches them all off guard, as perhaps it does Stilts himself. With a vaguely apologetic grimace, he starts to fish in his pocket.
Here's a trinket. Don't let me catch you praying to it, though.
He flips a coin in Mektu's direction, but it is Khandri who snaps it from the air. The coin is large and bright, newly minted silver. On one side is the image of the Palace of Radiance, on the other the Prophet herself, or rather the Prophet as she was nearly 50 years before, and as she likes still to be portrayed. The young visionary, not yet a mother, soon to launch a war.
The future Empress of Uroth, says Stilts dryly.
Well, I'll be off. A good meal's coming, but for the love of Ong, go and bathe while the water's hot. You boys look like cannibals. And lads, he raises a warning finger, don't go exploring. The exits are guarded, but the cavern's immense, and something of a maze. Stick to these chambers until you're sent for again. Do I make myself clear?
As a bell, says Chindelin. Don't worry, I'll keep them in line.
Do that, says Stilts. He pulls the curtains shut behind him, and his footfalls echo down the hall.
Khandri turns on his uncle.
Keep us in line, he says. Still counting on that, are you?
The others look at him, speechless.
Don't talk to him that way, says Eshet at last. He's your elder, no matter what he's done.
What's he done? Says Mektu.
Khandri flips his brother the coin. Mektu holds it up to the torchlight, reverses it, and freezes.
Oh. Mektu? Says Eshet.
Mektu hides his face in his elbow. The coin falls, landing soundless on the rug between them. It winks, the silver contours of a young woman's face in profile, slender cheeks, dimpled chin, deep, enormous eye.
That's her, says Khandri.
The smith looks slightly crazed.
Of course, he says. It's the prophet in her youth.
From Mektu's chest, a barely audible moan.
Do you mind telling me, says Khandri, why she has the face of the white child?
Mektu jerks like a snapped bowstring, turning from them, careening for the doorway. Eshet rushes after him. She tells him not to be a coward.
This isn't cowardice. This is intelligence, he shouts. Don't tell him, uncle! Don't say another fucking word!
Eshet steps into the doorway, blocking his escape.
You need to hear this, whatever it is, she says. Maybe he should have told you a long time ago, but all the same you need to hear it. You can't stay ignorant forever.
Hell if I can't, says Mektu.
He lunges past her and through the curtains. Eshet follows, calling his name. Khandri rounds on his uncle again.
We have 2 hours, he says. If you want to keep me in line, you'll tell me everything. I'm liable to get very far out of line if you put me off again.
I don't know everything, says Chindelin. I can't explain where she found the child or how it was made, if it was made.
Stop telling me what you don't know. Shouldn't you bathe first?
They've heated water, by damn, and you smell like the back of a butcher's shop.
Uncle.
Right.
The smith makes a gesture of surrender. He rubs his face, big hands trembling. Then he jabs a finger at the samovar.
Is there tea in that fucking thing?
They were children, all of them.
A pack of boys, the eldest barely 16, the youngest, Lantor Hingeman, a gangly 9. He was the mascot, the tag-along. Bright, foolish, everybody's darling. Educated, too. His father was the headmaster of the secular school in Ashfield. Well-fed on rice and milk and mutton. Barefoot half the year. Of course, the Chilotos remained a subject clan and had to yield a quarter of all they grew or built or earned to the Vajeks. They were expected to embrace the obscene idea of a single god and to kneel if the regional governor should pass. But the conqueror's presence in the Satapre Valley never amounted to constant day-to-day control. They were simply too few. They seized Nandipatar and slaughtered its ruling families, billeted soldiers at Green Pass and Bittermoon, now and then staged an execution. But the great purges happened elsewhere. The valley, never known for courage or resistance, coughed up treasure without much prompting, and so escaped the worst. Lantor Hingeman knew about Vajek atrocities, which had claimed some of his distant kin. He had also heard of the quarantine and the plague. Yet he was happy in those early years. The summers were warm, the winters bearable. His father indulged his love of tools and tinkering, let him dismantle an accordion and his mother's wind-up music box, and called him a whipcrack when both devices, reassembled, sounded better than before. They were well off. They had livestock and windows that sealed. They had cords of dry firewood, a cask of wine in the basement, an icebox filled each year with a thick slab cut from Moti Lake. Lantor's good fortune embarrassed him. He wondered if anyone else in Blindstream had half so many things. Then his father met a Lanyatu woman of exceptional beauty and ran off with her to the south, and overnight they were poor. They gave up meat, sold the cow and horses and even the barn that had housed them. Lantor's elder brother and sister quit school and took jobs in Nandipatar, sending home any money they could save. Lantor's mother worked like a fiend, sewing clothes, buying finished leather and fashioning it into bridles and belts, hawking her creations door to door, from Sed Hemen to Ashfield and beyond. Some days, Lantor imagined that all that labor was for him, the youngest, the darling, the one who earned no money. How could they help but despise him? That same spring, Lantor's pack of friends was abruptly decimated. One boy was killed by fever, another in a fall. Two others, cousins to Lantor, were snatched up by Vajeks and marched away to the Loro Canyon, where they died in one of many attempts to repair the Imperial Bridge. Hunger, fever, death, it was all mere happenstance.
"But what compares to happenstance," says Chindelin, "in the shaping of our lives?"
9-year-old Lantor was crushed and frightened. He had many evenings alone while his mother dragged her wares about the countryside. He needed someone. He fell in with older boys. They were nothing like his former friends. They called themselves the Strays. They made him walk a little behind, cuffed his head if he spoke up or laughed too loudly, especially in front of girls. But they were also fond of him. He cut capers, did impressions of adults. He made them laugh. And young though he was, Lantor Hingeman could be counted on to notice things. A shortcut, a spot in the river where the fish were plentiful, an unfriendly glance. Their leader's name was Samidya. He was a tall boy with a long, flat brow and shoulders that rounded forward, as though he were pulling a cart. At 16 he was already a thief, a small-time counterfeiter, and a peddler of his father's dubious moonshine. He did not boast of these pursuits. In fact, he rarely spoke of them at all. This had the effect of making them all the more alluring. Samidya was careful. He inducted the boys only gradually into his secrets, his petty crimes. But a day came when Lantor, licking his fingers after his share of a stolen lamb pie, looked around at the older boys and thought, "Pitfire, you're just a gang of crooks." And these crooks were all he had. That night Samidya told them something startling. He had a girlfriend, or as he called her, a lick. Lantor did not understand why Samidya spoke of her in this vulgar way,
nor exactly what a girlfriend was. He did understand that they were valuable, something to be coveted, something likely to be stolen when your back was turned.
"Who is she?"
someone asked. Samidia explained that she was the oldest girl in the New Life Orphanage.
"She's not even a Chiloto. She's fair-skinned, like a jute. She's a nasty piece of work, but she gets away with it because she's built. Just you remember that she's mine, though. Don't look at her. Find your own."
"How are we to do that?"
said Lantor, dejected, for Samidia would leave them now, and once again the circle would collapse. Girlfriends had this curious power. They made boys forget friends. Husbands walk out on wives. Samidia made as if to cuff Lantor as usual, but the hand froze in midair. He looked at the younger boy, but he was not really looking. His eyes were distant and fascinated. Then he blinked and gave them all a cunning smile. 2 nights later, very late, Lantor awoke to the sound of pebbles striking his window. Down in the street stood one of the older boys, all but dancing with impatience. Lantor lifted the sash.
"Get your clothes on," the boy called softly. "Samidia has a job for you. 5 gam.
5 gam? Lantor dressed in the darkness, praying his mother would not wake. The gang's leader had summoned him at night before, to climb a drain spout, to slip under a fence. But this time would be different. Samidia had never paid anyone for their services.
5 gam?
He repeated when he stood beside the boy.
6,
said the boy, mistaking Lantor's wonder for hesitation.
"Make it 6, I don't care. 2 now, and 4 more when it's over. If you do your job.
Who's paying me, you or Sam?"
The boy dug in his pocket, slapped 2 dull coins into Lantor's hand.
"I'm paying, but Samidia said it had to be you. No one but Hingeman," he said.
Without further explanation, he led Lantor at a run down the said Hemmen Road. Lantor was thrilled. He couldn't guess the nature of the job, but he was almost certain of their destination. 10 minutes later, he was proven correct when they turned up the path to the New Life Orphanage. The institution was already some 80 years old. It consisted of a square, squat building, too large for its 30 girls and 5 keepers, and a miasmic garden that had gone years without a pruning. A high stone wall surrounded both. In the daytime, the girls were allowed into the garden, but the wild exuberance of the plant life kept them confined to an ever-shrinking circle of grass. Their mistresses, aging women from an austere sect known as the Handmaids of Ong, were abstracted and poorly paid. They kept order by keeping a tight grip on the keys, and an even tighter one on the girls' imaginations.
"They were pitiless, those handmaids," says Chindelin. "They told the girls who'd come there as infants that they'd been saved from shipwrecks, rubbish tips, cannibals, that they'd be treated as fallen women, beaten, raped, if they set foot outside the wall before they were 20.
Until then, the orphans prayed and studied and washed their colorless frocks out with rainwater and made pillows, thousands of pillows, day and night, winter and summer, plucking geese, ducks, green fowl, babblers. Lantor had seen the dead birds arrive by the cartload and emerge naked, bound for valley butcher shops. But he had never seen a New Life girl. How had Samidia managed to smuggle one out? As it happened, he had not. Fear was too powerful a gatekeeper. But Samidia had at least discovered a gate, or rather a door. It was hidden by a bamboo thicket, and locked, of course. But Samidia had both tools and talent, and the girl inside had been whispering to him for days.
"I want food. I want candy. Bring me candy and you can do what you like."
"You have to wonder, by the gods," says Chindelin, "what sort of Uroth we'd be living in today, if one girl had not wanted sugar, one petty thief not known his locks."
The door opened into an abandoned potting shed, built into a far corner of the wall. That night, when Lantor and the older boy arrived, Samidia was already inside. He opened the door some 8 inches, as far as the bamboo allowed, and snapped at them.
"Get in here! What took you so long?"
In the putrid shed, he lit a candle. He barely glanced at Lantor. His hand was extended to the older boy.
"Where's the other 50?
The boy produced a handful of coins, each one thicker and heavier than the two he had given Lantor. Samidia counted them, nodded, and poked the other boy in the